And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
Tuesday, June 19th will mark 2 years since President Joe Biden declared Juneteenth to be a new federal holiday. Many people will celebrate the holiday, but not everyone knows what the holiday means. While many holidays are celebrated, some, such as Juneteenth, are meant to serve as a reflection. Indiana University Northwest will host a series of events set to educate as well as inform the community about this day that celebrates Black history. Joining us now is James Wallace, the Director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. Dr. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Dee. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Wallace, IUN will celebrate Juneteenth, a now federally recognized holiday, with a slew of events set to educate, inform, as well as inspire community members right here in Northwest Indiana. Now, before we dig into what you and your colleagues have planned on the campus, take a moment to talk about the importance of recognizing Juneteenth.
Well, again, thank you, Dee, for having me on the call today and asking about what we've got going on for Juneteenth. Certainly, it's an important holiday that has been a long time coming. You know, I was doing some research and looked to see when the first state had those celebrations or was officially recognized as a holiday, and that was Texas in 1979. And it wasn't until 42 years later when the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act was signed into law by President Biden that it officially commemorated it as a federal holiday. You know, prior to that, most of the time, this holiday was celebrated, you know, in the South, certainly in Texas, and I've spoken to folks in Georgia and other areas in the South where they've celebrated it. But they hasn't been celebrated as much, you know, in these areas, in these communities. And the holiday itself is so very important because it gives us an opportunity to reflect on where we've been as a nation, reflect on justice for all citizens, particularly for African American citizens in this country, and provides an opportunity for us to learn more of our history, celebrate, you know, where we're going with hope and being very aspirational in what we're trying to do. So we're still trying to figure out how best to do it in this area, but I thought that putting together opportunities to both celebrate, inform, have discussions would be the appropriate way for us as a university to celebrate the holiday.
You're so right. And just this time last year, I set aside a full hour to, again, educate and inform community members right here in Northwest Indiana about the history of Juneteenth, even discussing the grandmother of Juneteenth, Ms. Opal Lee, who, of course, was behind the whole movement of ensuring that Juneteenth is now a federally recognized holiday. And so while we all are trying to figure out how best to recognize and celebrate Juneteenth, I think that the events that you'll be hosting at IU Northwest are an awesome start to continue the conversation, to continue to educate community members right here in the region about Juneteenth. So as I shared, the IU Northwest Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs will host multiple events on campus, from food, dance, culture, film screenings, workshops, and more. So let's start with one of the events that really piqued my interest, so much so that I'll be speaking with a curator later on in the show. Tell us about the Emancipation Display.
Well, Jeremy Pekarek, who is the archivist for the Calumet Regional Archives, he's only been on campus for a short time, but he's made a tremendous impact, you know, researching and finding information that's there, hidden nuggets and gems of history that he can highlight to make connections between the university and the surrounding community. And he's unearthed information about John Eubanks, who was a Gary Revitt student and one of the oldest Civil War veterans. He passed some time ago, but he was the oldest Civil War veteran that was a Gary resident. And he, you know, made connections there and is able to share that in a display that's been curated, of course, by Jeremy. And, you know, there are a number of books that we have available focused on Juneteenth that were curated by Cynthia Zemanski, the acting assistant dean of the library and head of technical services, and Debbie Curtis, the head of circulation and reserves. They've compiled wonderful displays that are in our library conference center. So folks are certainly invited to come there and take a look at those in those display cases and learn more about the Juneteenth holiday, the timeline of events that led us to where we are today. And I'm just really proud to be able to work with constituents on campus to put displays of that nature together.
We're speaking with Dr. James Wallace, the director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs at Indiana University Northwest. Dr. Wallace, you alluded to this already, but I want to unpack this a little bit more. I note another event set for the month of June is the 21-Day Racial Equity Juneteenth Challenge. Talk a bit more about that and what that means.
Sure. The 21-Day Equity Challenge for Juneteenth was the creation of Dr. Eddie Moore. He's a racial justice educator, and he actually organizes the White Privilege Conference each year. And he worked with a gentleman that has the traveling Black History Museum. And they put together this 21 challenge to give individuals an opportunity to read, you know, short snippets of information about the Juneteenth holiday, watch videos, reflect. And there's exercises that people can do each day for 21 days. And then there's a tracker. You can keep track of what you've learned. And what I've decided to do was to pull people together for weekly Zoom sessions. So we had our first one. So every Tuesday the 13th and the 20th at 3 p.m., folks will be able to log on to the Zoom link and discuss what they've discovered, what new insights they've learned. And this is an opportunity for folks to get more information about the Juneteenth holiday and educate themselves in an environment that's nurturing and supportive. So, you know, that's something unique that we've been doing this year. And I would note that we've received support from Indiana Humanities to have some other events this past year. So I just wanted to mention them as supporters of this effort to educate the community about the Juneteenth holiday.
That sounds exciting, and that creates a sense of community. So I like that additional piece of bringing people together virtually to kind of unpack and share what they have learned, because they're also able to learn from other people.
Exactly. So if individuals are interested in participating in that, they can go to iun.edu/diversity and then scroll down and click on any of the calendar reminders for the 21-Day Equity Challenge, and then they can participate. They can download the workbook. They can download the tracker. They can have links to some of the resources to read, watch, and react to.
Dr. Wallace, one thing I know for sure, a meal will always put people in a good mood, and food also creates a shared experience, bringing us all together. And I bring up this point because on Tuesday, June 13th, IU Northwest will host the big kickoff event. So tell us about what you guys have planned for that day.
Well, Tuesday, June 13th, we'll have a kickoff celebration in our library courtyard pavilion right behind our library on 3400 Broadway. Between 11:30 and 1, we're going to have a kickoff to the Juneteenth events for that week. And that'll have food. We've got some food catered by a local restaurant. Some music. We have a playlist of songs that, you know, focused on Juneteenth and empowerment, some history. We have actually a reenactment. The Sons of the Union Veterans of the Civil War, we have individuals on campus that are participants in the reserves. The Sons of the Union Veterans of the Civil War are the legal heirs to the Grand Army of the Republic. It was chartered by the 83rd Congress. And we have someone who works at the library who was going to wear some ceremonial military garb and actually read General Gordon Granger's General Order Number 3, which informed the people of Texas that all those formerly enslaved are now free. So he's going to read that. That's going to kick off our celebration. Then we'll have Jeremy Bekerik, the archivist, share information about Juneteenth and formerly enslaved people who lived in Gary. And then we'll have food and then music and just a great celebration on that day. So we're inviting folks to come on out. We have giveaways and free gifts and t-shirts and food and fun. And we're just asking folks to come on out and enjoy themselves on that day.
Wow, that sounds so exciting. We're speaking with Dr. James Wallace, the director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs at Indiana University Northwest. Now, Dr. Wallace, other events include a movie screening as well as the culminating event co-sponsored with the IU Northwest School of the Arts and the South Shore Dance Alliance. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Well, sure. We've got, you know, three more events during that week. Thursday, June 15th, we'll have a screening of the film Emancipation that stars Will Smith as a runaway enslaved person who headed for Baton Rouge And that film came out in 2022. It's a historical action thriller set in Louisiana in the 1860s after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. So we'll show that film on campus in the Dunes Medical Professional Building, room 2001. Between 1 and 4 p.m., the film lasts about 2 hours, almost 2.5 hours, and then we'll have some time there for some discussion afterwards. We'll have some light refreshments there, first come, first serve. So we're inviting people to come out for that event on June 15th between 1 and 4 in the Dunes Medical Professional Building, room 2001. We're asking folks to register for that, so they can also go to that link, iun.edu/diversity, scroll down to the calendar, and then they can find the link there to register for that. Also, Friday and Saturday, June 16th and 17th, we are hosting Just Leadership USA Emerging Leadership Workshop. This workshop, sponsored by Just Leadership USA, is by a group that's coming out of Michigan. And what they do is they have training targeted towards individuals or their families who've been impacted by the criminal justice system. And this emerging leadership training shows them how to advocate for policy changes to improve their lives. No one is more closer to the answers to some of the challenges that these folks are faced, but they're also farther away from having the power or authority to make those changes. So this training is designed to provide them with the skill set to do that effectively. So folks are asked to come to both the training on the 16th and the 17th, both days. Breakfast and lunch will be provided. It's free of charge, and the training is from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on both days. So Friday and Saturday, June 16th and 17th, in the Library Conference Center, room 105 A, B, and C, is where that training is going to take place. And again, we're asking folks to register for that so we have an idea of how many people to expect. And people will receive a certificate of participation after they've completed the second day's training. Our final event that we're going to have is a dance performance by the South Shore Dance Alliance, led by Larry Brewer. And this performance is entitled Freedom in America, Conversation and Movement, Juxtaposition. And both Saturday and Sunday will be a free performance of this in our main stage theater in our College of Arts and Science building. It's the new building, it's on the east side of Broadway, right there at 34th and Broadway. Saturday's performance will begin at 7 p.m. on June 17th. Sunday's performance will begin on June 18th at 2:30. It's a matinee. And it features IU Northwest students, Nikhil Scott, and alumni Cheyenne Johnson. And it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for the community to come out and enjoy this dance performance. So, you know, again, we have a full slate of activities all week long that people can come to campus and enjoy. It's free of charge. There's no cost associated with it. We're just asking folks to go ahead and register for those events at the iun.edu/diversity and then scroll down to the calendar pages and you can see the list of events that we have for the campus to enjoy for Juneteenth.
Finally, Dr. Wallace, in the minute or so that we have left, I want to end our conversation by circling back to one of the events that you just mentioned, and that's the Just Leadership USA Emerging Leadership Workshop. Now, our listeners may tune in and say, hey, I thought this was a conversation about Juneteenth and celebrating Juneteenth. And they may ask, why would IUN host an event that will stress the effectiveness of social support interventions for the formerly incarcerated on the campus in concert with recognizing Juneteenth? So in the time that we have left, share with our listening audience why you felt that it was important to include this particular workshop.
Well, the 13th Amendment, while it eradicated slavery, it kept in a provision that it could be maintained for people who have been convicted of a crime. You know, that's our criminal justice system. That's our incarceration system, in which disproportionate numbers of African Americans have become ensnared. And when these individuals are released into society, while on paper they would have satisfied their obligation, that's not in reality for many. That's not a reality for them. They have a very difficult time reestablishing themselves. And there's all sorts of measures that have been put in place to disenfranchise them from being fully effective, fully self-actualized citizens. So there's a direct connection between Juneteenth and our carceral system. So having this kind of discussion will empower our community of people to be able to advocate for themselves. So I see the connection between the two, Juneteenth and this training. And, you know, we're pleased to be able to partner with so many community partners to bring this event to campus. The Gary Commission on the Social Status of Black Males is a sponsor of this. We've had folks from Purdue Northwest that are co-sponsoring this activity. And it's really a community effort to provide some information that will help our community be better.
Dr. Wallace, I think that's a great way to end our conversation for today. James Wallace is the Director of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs at Indiana University Northwest. Dr. Wallace, again, thank you so much for spending time with us today on Regionally Speaking.
My pleasure, Dee. Thank you again for the opportunity.
And coming up after the break, we'll be continuing our conversation about Juneteenth celebrations at Indiana University Northwest by bringing you a conversation with IUN archivist Jeremy Pekarik, who found some interesting paperwork regarding a former slave turned Union soldier who spent his final years in the city of Gary. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. Juneteenth, the now federally recognized holiday, which began as an event to celebrate the end of slavery in Texas, has become a day to remember and commemorate the emancipation of slavery throughout the United States. Also called Jubilation Day or Freedom Day, Juneteenth refers to Monday, June 19, 1865, more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, that Union soldiers arrived in Galveston, Texas, and announced the liberation of America's more than 3 million enslaved people. In recognition of Juneteenth, Indiana University Northwest will host a series of events on its regional campus. Joining us now to talk about one of those events is Jeremy Pekarik, an archivist who recently discovered the story of a former slave who spent his final years in Gary. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much, Dee, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. Now, Jeremy, we are living in the year 2023, and while our country is torn with revisiting the painful past of slavery in America, in honor of Juneteenth, a now federally recognized holiday, Indiana University Northwest will host events, including showcasing your research recognizing the life and legacy of John Eubanks, a survivor of slavery and a Civil War veteran who lived his final years in Gary. Before we take a deep dive into what you have uncovered to date, take a moment to tell our listening audience about the work you do at IUN, as well as what led you to discover the interview documented as part of the Federal Writers Project in 1937.
Oh, sure. So I'm an archivist here, and so I work on the third floor of the library at IUN, and I document and I preserve the local history as well as the institutional history of the college. And so we have a range of collections, from community collections to institutional collections. And what I was doing here was actually, I was conducting research into an exhibit that was going to be hosted for Juneteenth. Now, the exhibit idea initially was to just have something displayed within the library lobby, and then it started to slowly grow from that point, I would say. So we do have a display in the lobby right now, but we will have two retractable banners that we're calling our exhibit because they can be relocated to different areas. So my research started out by just researching an exhibit on Juneteenth. And so I have information on the display from the Civil War regarding the Emancipation Proclamation, General Order Number 3, which was read by General Granger. I have information on legislative history of Juneteenth. And then I have some information on voices of slavery. And that's how I kind of came across John's information and his story.
Now, the interviews for the Federal Writers Project, published in Slave Narratives, A Folk History of Slavery in the United States, are told in the voice of the past. Not some Hollywood fictional tale, but first-person accounts, right? So, tell us about John Eubanks.
Sure. So, John Eubanks was born into slavery in the 1830s. Actually, his birth date varies. Some suggest that he was born on June 3rd, and then the other suggests it was June 6th, so this week, actually. And John and his family, his mother and siblings, were enslaved on the Everett Plantation in Barron County, Kentucky. Jesse Everett, the patriarch of the plantation, gave John, when he was just 6 years old, to his daughter and son-in-law, the Eubanks, as a wedding present, which is obviously an unfortunate and dreadful custom of slavery that occurred. And this is when John assumed his last name, Eubanks. John describes in his narrative leaving the Eubanks in the early 20s to join the Union Army. And according to his interview, he fought for Company K of the 108th Kentucky Infantry, which I have confirmed. And investigation into John's military career, though it's still ongoing, he does mention two key battles that took place during the Civil War. And the first one is Sherman's March to the Sea and the massacre at Fort Pillow, which he survived. After the war, John was reunited with his mother and his siblings. And remember, they were separated when he was just only 6 years old.
Wow.
And and he married his wife a year later in 1866. And they got married on Christmas Day, and I believe her name is Julia. They would then move to Louisville, Kentucky, where they spent the majority of their marriage. And John worked as a laborer in a lumber yard until his wife passed away. And then in 1924 is when John made his way to Gary, Indiana, which was during the Great Migration. He would come to live with his daughter, Bertha Sloss, S-L-O-S-S. And according to John's interview, they lived on Harrison Boulevard. But city directories kind of contradict that, and they suggest that he lived on Van Buren Street. So John passed away in 1938, and he's buried in Oak Hill Cemetery right here in Gary. Now, if you step back and think about John's journey here for a minute, it's really remarkable because he survived slavery. He fought for the Union in the Civil War, survived that, and then lived through Reconstruction, the Industrial Revolution, the Great Migration, World War I, the Great Depression, and passed away just before World War II was underway. And he gave his interview shortly before he passed, only a year, I think, before he actually passed away. And that interview, as you mentioned, was part of the Federal Writers Project in the WPA in the late 1930s.
We're speaking with Jeremy Pakarik, an archivist at Indiana University Northwest.
Now, Jeremy, let me ask you something. So at the time of the recording of the life of John Eubanks in 1937, he was Gary's only surviving, as you shared, Civil War veteran. Now, while he was born as a slave on either June 3rd or June 6th, as you've pointed out, as you've detailed, take a moment to share why it is so important to note his life as a part of the fabric of the city of Gary.
Sure. And I want to expand on that first part there for a moment, because sure. John was the oldest surviving member of the Grand Army of the Republic, which is a fraternal organization in the Civil War, made up of Union veterans. And depending on the records you look at regarding John's birth and death, it kind of varies. So John may have lived to be 98, or he may have lived to be 102. That is kind of in question right now. It's not something that needs to be looked into more regarding slavery in the Civil War and their connection to Gary. And I think it's really important because there could be possibly descendants who still live here in the region. And what I'm hoping that this interview can do is act as like a call to living descendants of John or potentially anybody else who may have memorabilia, stories, or information, or just want to sit down and have a conversation, I would encourage them to reach out to me at the archives of IU Northwest, and we can kind of take that from there. Today, in fact, I actually met with a descendant of slavery virtually via Zoom, connected to the plantation where John was enslaved. And we had a remarkable conversation, and it turns out this person had done some research on their own already, and then we're going to start talking and collaborating some more moving forward.
Wow, I am just, you know, as I share with you offline, I am just so fascinated by your research. Now, Jeremy, so as we reflect on the life of John Eubanks, it's not lost on me that while he was born into slavery, his grandparents were full-blooded Africans, meaning that he was only a second-generation American. I mean, let this sink in for a minute. A man whose ancestors were seized from their homeland, whose blood, sweat, and tears helped sustain the American economy, a slave himself, as you pointed out early in our conversation, made the ultimate sacrifice to serve with the Union Army. I mean, wow, right?
Absolutely. And I think you touched on an important topic there, is that if you really look at the infrastructure of the United States and the history of the United States, it's really connected to that history you just mentioned, right? You can't ignore it. You have to confront it and acknowledge it. And so what we come to know as the United States today was largely built by an enslaved population, which is obviously unfortunate and very sad to reconcile with. But also, it's important to share their stories and to understand who they are as individuals and start to reconcile that.
Right, right. Now, I understand that at the time the interview was recorded, Mr. Eubanks was nearing the age of 100, even though, as you've already shared, we're not sure of his exact age. But sometimes, not all of the times, but sometimes as we age, our memory, our ability to recollect is not as effortless as it was when we were a bit younger. So do you know if he was able to recall his story in great detail himself, or did he have to rely on family members to kind of help share his story?
Oh, absolutely. So during the interview process, I should mention that John was interviewed by a gentleman named Archie Koritz. And during the interview process, he mentions that he relied on his daughter and his family to try to recall some of the stories he had told them over the years. So you're absolutely right. I mean, he was around 98 years old, depending on when he was born, when he gave the interview. And he had mentioned several battles within the Civil War with a lot of notoriety, such as Sherman's March to the Sea and Fort Pillow massacre. And he also mentions a third battle on Morgan's Raid as well. And so there are some things that you have to look into a little bit further, especially when it comes to his military career, to just, some of those things have dates associated with them. You could easily go back and start to locate records regarding that. But I think that family did assist him in his interview, which makes absolute sense. And he did live with his daughter in Gary at the time. He ended up having 50 grandchildren, which is amazing.
Wow. That's amazing. That is truly and truly amazing. I'm curious about that as well.
We're speaking with Jeremy Pakarik, an archivist at Indiana University Northwest.
Now, Jeremy, I probably have said this 20 times in our conversation already, that I am fascinated, rather intrigued by the story of John Eubanks, as well as your research into his story, as well as the work that you're doing uncovering other stories of descendants of slavery right here in Northwest Indiana. Now, as you continue to dive into the history records, as I shared, I look forward to you discovering more information about descendants that are still living in the region. But in your research thus far, have you been able to locate any of John Eubanks' descendants?
That's a great point. And as we mentioned earlier, I've only actually had John's story for a couple weeks now. So
able to uncover this much in just a couple of weeks?
And so it sounds great, but and I appreciate that. And so I mentioned earlier, when I started to look in the WPA narratives and I located John's story, his story does appear in other web spaces, but it's a lot of times it's just the reprinting of the original narrative. So there needs to be more original research into John and his history and his legacy. And so part of this call, as I said, I'm hoping that folks might come forward and just say, I know about John, or I may be related to him, or maybe we can start looking into that some more, having conversations. I am working with the Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War, and they have they're located here in Valparaiso, Indiana, and they've been extremely helpful with helping me uncover some of this research so far, and there's so much more to do. I can imagine that I will be going to other local repositories here in Gary, as well as our own archive, the IUN, to try and cover newspaper records, other military records, family records, doing some genealogy work, and just trying to discover who John really, really was beyond the narrative and how we can explore that further.
Finally, Jeremy, as you shared earlier, the continuing work that you are doing to research and uncover the deeply moving story of the life of former slave John Eubanks is a part of the month-long Juneteenth celebration on the campus of Indiana University Northwest. Now, as we wrap up our conversation for today, again, please share the details with our listening audience of how they can view your curated work, the Emancipation Display.
Absolutely. So IU Northwest will hold a Juneteenth kickoff event on June 13th, and programming will be extended from the 13th and on. During that first day of the 13th, there will be free food giveaways, music, and the display with John on it will be there as well when folks come to attend. And he will be up for the remainder of the month here at IUN. But I also want to say that the banner, the exhibit that John appears on, will also be at the Freedom Festival in Maryville on June 17th. And I would encourage folks to come out and attend and just have a good time and enjoy not only the exhibit, but enjoy the events that are going to be going on, because IUN's really doing quite a bit through the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. They have a whole line of programming set up.
Jeremy, again, in your role as an archivist at IUN, you have uncovered a truly remarkable story that we all need to hear as well as learn from. It is my hope that more storytellers come forward to share the story of their descendants. I thank you so much, Jeremy, for spending time with us today on Lakeshore Public Media.
Thank you so much, Dee, for having me. It was a real pleasure.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. According to a survey of employers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, employment growth was far stronger than expected in May. Over the last 3 months, the economy has added more than 300,000 jobs, well above the economy's long-run potential. Commentary from PNC Financial Services Group shares this strength in the labor market is much welcome news for the Federal Reserve. Joining us now is Senior Economist and Assistant Vice President Abby Omondumbe with a monthly economic outlook. Abby, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me again, Dee.
Okay, Abby, so we're in the second week of June, and that means that we have some new job numbers. What are your thoughts on the numbers that were recently released?
Yes, you are right. We got some new job numbers. The job numbers were surprising. They were positively surprising. So the BLS employment situation summary is made up of two surveys, a household survey and an establishment survey. So for the establishment survey, you know, the government asks business about their employment in the previous month. And the establishment survey showed a big increase in employment in May. So 339,000 jobs were added in May. This was more than PNC's forecast for 190,000 jobs to be added to the U.S. economy. And this essentially shows that there's still a lot of strength in the U.S. labor market. And this isn't particularly great news for the Fed. Given the sharp increase in interest rates since March of 2022, the strength in the labor market is exceptional. The household survey told a different story. So the household survey showed that the unemployment rate increased to 3.7% in May from 3.4% in April, and employment levels declined. So we saw an increase in unemployed folks and, you know, a decrease in employed folks. So to summarize the report, the headline number was exceptionally strong. The details were more encouraging. We saw slower wage growth. We saw a slight increase in the labor force. But the Fed likely still has some more work to do because the labor market is too strong. And, you know, the Fed has more work to do in order for them to fulfill the dual mandate of maximum employment and price stability.
Right. Now, Abby, I want to shift for just a moment for our topic. We've had increased political uncertainty in recent weeks with the debt ceiling conversations in the government. So would the current deal affect the U.S. economy?
A debt limit agreement is great news for the U.S. economy. A government default would have been disastrous for the U.S. economy, particularly where the U.S. economy is now with high inflation and also with elevated interest rates. A default would have resulted in a severe recession. We would have seen big losses, and we would have likely seen higher interest rates for consumers and businesses. Like you said, the good news is that folks in Congress were able to come up with an agreement. But with that agreement, there will be drains in government spending for the fiscal years of 2024 and 2025. PNC Economics forecast that, you know, that will most likely shave off about a tenth of a percentage point of real GDP in 2024 and 2025. So there will be a minimal negative impact from the spending constraints. So again, like I said, we're likely to see about a tenth of a percentage point shaved off real GDP in 2024 and 2025.
Okay, Abby, so the Federal Reserve will meet next week. What are you expecting from that meeting?
Our base case is for the Federal Reserve to maintain the Fed's funds rate at the current level of 5 to 5.25% until early 2024. You know, we're forecasting a mild recession, which will most likely start in the second half of the year and last through the first half of 2024. And we don't expect the Fed to start reducing the Fed's funds rate until early 2024. With that being said, risks are tilted towards the Fed increasing the Fed's funds rate further, particularly after today's strong employment report. You know, so we will continue to monitor incoming data. Inflation data will be released on June 13. The Fed meets on June 13 and June 14. And I think that if we continue to see strong economic data releases, you know, right, if inflation surprises to the upside, you know, when that is released, you know, if other economic indicators continue to suggest that there's still a lot of strength in the U.S. economy, then I think it's very likely that the Fed will increase the Fed's funds rate further, either in June or in July.
Finally, Abby, in the few minutes that we have left, what are your expectations for the regional and national economies for 2024?
So the manufacturing sector is a big part of Indiana's economy, and the U.S. manufacturing sector is in recession now. Higher interest rates are, you know, weighing on the demand for durable goods. When the pandemic started, you know, in 2020, we saw a shift in consumer spending away from services to durable goods. In the past year, we've seen a reversal of that trend. So we're seeing consumers spend more on services and less on durable goods. And, you know, that is weighing on Indiana's economy. So I expect the manufacturing contraction to continue through 2023. So in the near term, I think we're going to see more weakness in the regional economy. In the longer term, positive demographic trends will benefit the economy. So we're likely to see solid population growth, which would be positive for Indiana's economy. For the U.S. economy, you know, again, our forecast remains for a mild recession, which will most likely start in the second half of this year. And that will be driven by higher interest rates. We're likely to see a pullback in consumer spending, particularly a pullback in consumer spending on durable goods. We're going to see a pullback in business investments. And, you know, and we're expecting it to be a mild contraction, which, again, will most likely last through the first half of 2024.
Abby Omadumbe is a senior economist and assistant vice president with the PNC Financial Services Group. Abby, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, and I look forward to talking to you next month with another look at the regional and national economy.
Thank you so much, Lee.
And coming up after the break, Morning Edition host Chris Nolte speaks with representatives about a big $3 million expansion of a Catholic school right here in the region. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Big Shoulders Fund has been working very closely with the Catholic Diocese of Gary and other partners to help improve education in the Catholic Diocese of Gary region of all the schools. In particular, they've been very proud of the expansions they've been able to do, improvements to the schools. And the biggest one is coming up with an opportunity to see on Monday, June 12th. It's an expansion of $3 million to improve the Aquinas Catholic Community School in Merrillville. And to tell us more about not only the Big Shoulders Fund of Northwest Indiana and the Catholic Diocese and the school in particular, we have Dan Kozlowski, who is the managing director of Big Shoulders Fund of Northwest Indiana, along with the principal of Aquinas Catholic Community School, Lisa Gutierrez. And Dan and Lisa, thank you for joining us for Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having us on.
Well, Dan, if you will, first tell us a little bit about Big Shoulders Fund. We've had conversations in the past about it, but it's been a while. Bring us up to date on the Big Shoulders Fund in general, what they're doing here in Northwest Indiana first.
Absolutely. Well, Big Shoulders Fund began in the mid-1980s in Chicago as a way to raise money for scholarship support for inner city youth that wanted to attend Catholic schools in Chicago but didn't have the financial means to do so. Over time, our organization, as we worked with these Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Chicago, began to realize that these schools needed more than just financial help. They needed operational support. They needed academic support and everything that goes along with running the operation of a Catholic school. Longtime benefactors of Big Shoulders Fund, Beth and Bruce White, saw that opportunity to bring programming into Northwest Indiana and made a gift of $16 million over 10 years to bring Big Shoulders Fund programming into Northwest Indiana. And again, that was in 2019 when I began, and we started working with the Catholic schools here in Northwest Indiana almost immediately. And honestly, one of the first Catholic schools we had conversation with was Aquinas Catholic Community School in Merrillville. And at that time, Lisa Gutierrez shared with us her vision of connecting two buildings at the school to just make a walkway in between. The kids didn't have to go outside. And over a year or two, you know, during COVID and that, we had more conversations with, well, let's dream bigger. How can we make this project larger? How can we help serve the students, not only of Merrillville, but the many students of the Gary community that Lisa serves at her school? And we were able to help, through the generosity of the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation, help make a $1.95 million gift to help with the expansion, the $3 million expansion of this building. So we're very proud to work with not only Aquinas, but with all the Catholic schools in Northwest Indiana to help to continue to grow these schools and make them thrive and be the pillars of the community that they are.
Now, Lisa, since you're the principal of Aquinas Catholic Community School, will you tell us in particular what this total $3 million expansion project involves?
Absolutely. This project, Big Shoulders Fund, allowed us to kind of
dream beyond what our original vision was, we really needed two classrooms as our school continued to grow consistently every year. We were serving 10 grades, we're preschool to eighth grade, but we only had eight traditional sized classrooms. So we started using some rooms in another building that are a little bit smaller, not really designed to be classrooms, just to get by, all the while hoping to just connect these two buildings. And Big Shoulders Fund came in and said, you know, these two classrooms, that would be great. You'd be able to have full-size classes for all 10 of your grades, but let's talk about safety. Let's talk about offices. Let's talk about, you know, double-doored entrance and bulletproof glass and bulletproof walls, for crying out loud. It's terrible that we have to say that in this day and age, but this expansion project is not only allowing us to serve more scholars into the future, but it's dramatically increased safety and the efficiency of our complete functioning as a school.
I remember over time going past the school there on 73rd, and I remember seeing what portable classrooms were outside for the longest time. I know that was before a lot of this expansion took place here, because I knew that you all were running out of room very quickly.
Very quickly. You know, in doing this expansion and really digging into the history of the school, I learned that the original Aquinas school is four classrooms, and they had portables right then from the very beginning, always hoping and having an eye towards expansion. And slowly over decades, they did add, you know, two more classes and then two more classes, I think, in the 80s. And now here we are finally with 10 classrooms serving 10 grades, and there are no portable units on this property. Thank God.
Well, it's sometime or another, you hope that this is going to happen, and it's glad that it's actually happened now that you have this expansion to be able to give the youngsters who attend Aquinas Catholic Community School the opportunity for a good education. And it certainly benefits not only your students, I'm sure, but others in a way with the other schools in the Gary Diocese.
I'm really hopeful that our other schools will find this situation as an inspiration, as a reason for hope. You know, we could never have imagined this happening 7 years ago when I first became the principal here at Aquinas. Could never have imagined. I would have been thrilled with the hallway. They could have built the hallway and almost stopped back then. But now, I mean, to see this building, these classrooms are beautiful and safe and secure, and every kid deserves a quality education and a healthy, safe environment. So I can't say enough good things about Big Shoulders for allowing us to really dream big and do the absolute very best we could for kids.
Now, Dan, if you will, tell us a little bit about some of the behind-the-scenes work that the Big Shoulders Fund in Northwest Indiana has had to do, working with Bishop McClory, with the Diocese of Gary and his colleagues in the education end of the diocese, what they've had to do to work with Lisa and all the preparation work, I suppose, for the expansion itself.
No, absolutely. You know, it was a process. And when we began this process, we were in the middle of a worldwide pandemic. And, you know, that certainly brought about some challenges in terms of getting people together and really trying to determine what the educational landscape would look like coming out of COVID. But, you know, our resolve was very strong, and we had great partners in the diocese. And as you'd mentioned, particularly Bishop McClory and certainly his whole staff. You know, if there's one thing that is great, you know, certainly on our end as a partner, but for other partners that might be listening out there, the Diocese of Gary has a mindset that education is a key component in its mission to serve the Northwest Indiana community, as is ours. And we want to make sure that we have strong partners in that mission, because it is a worthy mission to make sure that our children in Northwest Indiana have a quality education and access to quality education. So, you know, with that in mind, you know, we had a great process of working with them, working with all the contractors that were involved, and really coming together and imagining a space that's conducive to learning. And it was a very smooth process, about as smooth as you could imagine a project of this size to be. And that really gives us hope that if other projects in the future were to come up, that you know, we wouldn't have any issues working with our partners in the diocese on those projects.
Hi, Lisa, this is Dee. So I note that the reason for the expansion is because of the 37% growth in student population. Mm-hmm. And at the start of the 2022-2023 school year, I had the privilege of speaking to the principal of Bishop Noe High School about this same topic. They were just excited about this growth in student population. And at the time of that conversation that I had with her, she said that it was in part because of the pandemic, as Dan just spoke about, in regards to trouble with the expansion and getting things done. But she also noted that it was because of the pandemic that parents became more involved because they, of course, were home with their kids and they saw their kids doing their Zoom school lessons. But she also noted that it was because of parental concern over school curriculum. So I just have a question. Do you note that as well as an additional reason for the growth in student population for your school?
Absolutely. We were growing before the pandemic even started. We started experiencing this growth. My first year here, which was 2016-17, we kind of did the hard work of redefining our culture, our mission statement, you know, choosing our core values and then really holding ourselves accountable to those. And I started to see the school culture do this flip. Prior to that, we had not been seeing any growth. In fact, the school had been experiencing a very slow decline in enrollment previously. So once we redefined those things and started really concentrating on living what we're saying we're doing every single day, we started to see things turn. I think curriculum is a concern. I also think just the basics of school culture is a concern for parents. I was a public school teacher. I have all love for our other schools out there. We are all out there doing the best we can, trying to love kids. But there's just nothing that can take the place of a Christ-based education. The values that the kids are learning, the way that we treat each other, the way that we talk to each other, the way we think about learning and what our kids are capable of is all fed by a faith. And I find that that is the thing more than anything else that our parents are yearning for is a loving, safe, peaceful environment where their kids are really encouraged to be who God intends them to be.
It's Lisa Gutierrez. She's the principal of Aquinas Catholic Community School in Maryville. And we're also speaking with Dan Koslowski, who's the managing director of the Big Shoulders Fund of Northwest Indiana, which has been working very closely with the Catholic Diocese of Gary and with, as well, the Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation in helping support this $3 million expansion project at the Aquinas Catholic Community School. And they're going to celebrate with a ribbon cutting on Monday the 12th. It's going to start at 2:00 in the afternoon with the big ceremony and continue on for an opportunity to check out the school and all the great things that have happened in the school until 4:00 on Monday afternoon. Lisa, will you give us some of the particulars of the program that is coming up beginning at 2:00 on Monday?
Absolutely. The ceremony will start at 2:00 with the traditional ribbon cutting and building blessing. There'll be a few speakers at this event, not incredibly long, I think, but there'll be Beth White, the main donor for this expansion project, myself, our bishop will be here, again, blessing the building. Once the formal piece to that is over, we do have our kindergarten and first graders coming out to do a song, a couple songs for everybody. But once that formal piece of the program is over, we've got student ambassadors ready to give tours to anyone who would like. There'll be a chef inside creating some delectables for us. There'll be food trucks outside. We'll have a gaming truck here. Lots of just joy. It's a celebration. There'll be a lot of fun things to do. There's no cost to attend this event. We hope the entire community comes out, just walks through, experience the school, get some snacks, you know, visit the gaming truck, visit our students, and find out what makes Aquinas so special.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much for telling us about the program coming up on Monday. Again, it starts at 2:00 in the afternoon with a ribbon cutting there at the Aquinas Catholic Community School in Maryville. And Dan Koslowski is the managing director of Big Shoulders Fund Northwest Indiana that's been working very closely with the Roman Catholic Diocese of Gary on all of the school projects within the diocese, but in particular on this very big project that's happening at the school in Maryville. Thank you, Dan, for joining us to talk about it today, as well as talk about the programs that the Big Shoulders Fund are supporting here in Northwest Indiana.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be on, as always.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. We'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.